This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Two memoranda issued by the Department of Homeland Security builds on an executive order signed by Donald Trump in January over new immigration guidelines. The promises that Trump made during his campaign to deport immigrants, which many of his own supporters didn't actually believe, are being implemented with frightening swiftness. President Barack Obama, who was certainly not a friend to immigrants, had put in place some protections, such as prioritizing of felony convicts for deportation and the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. But what is likely to transpire under Trump will far eclipse what immigrants faced under Obama. Already, the BBC is reporting that one Mexican man committed suicide near the border in Mexico this week, very shortly after being deported from the U.S. My guest is Meet Soni. She is a directing attorney with Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Welcome to the program, Meet.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about what these memoranda exactly specify. The executive order was signed by Donald Trump in January. The memoranda were published this week. As far as I can tell, and this is something that major media have attempted to sort of determine, are all approximately 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. now in danger of being deported?
I mean, I think that the way these memorandums and the executive orders coming off, I think definitely one of the takeaways is that there's going to be mass deportations despite their assurances to the contrary. So whether it's actually going to fulfill the promise of removing 11 million undocumented immigrants is, of course, yet to be seen. But definitely they're getting the machinery in place that they would need to carry out mass deportations.
And let's talk about that, because it's obviously not very easy, just practically speaking, to extricate 11 million people from the United States who are integrated into their communities, who hold jobs that many U.S. citizens might not do, who work in restaurants and fields as domestic workers, and to simply find out where they are, who they are, round them up and kick them out. For one thing, they would need to be the Border Patrol itself and the Department of Homeland Security would need to hire many, many more staff than they already have with money that hasn't been allocated, right?
That is correct. And in fact, if you look at both executive orders as well as the Kelly memorandums that came out, both of them contemplate and basically give the go-ahead to do mass hiring. So the hiring of 5,000 CBP officers. These would be officers at the borders, as well as 10,000 ICE officers. So 10,000 officers for the interior who would be very much responsible for carrying out the expedited removal aspect of both the executive order and the Kelly memo.
Kelly being Chief John Kelly of the department, he's basically the chief of the Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Homeland Security.
So let's talk about what was in place under Obama that prioritized, that had sort of various tiers of people who were most likely to face deportation versus people who were least likely to face deportation. We know that particularly in the later years of his presidential tenure, Obama made clear that he would not be seeking out, that Homeland Security under his administration would not be seeking out those undocumented immigrants who might never have committed crimes, but that they were really prioritizing those people who had been convicted of felonies. Do these memoranda under Trump do away with that prioritizing?
Yes, they do, very much so. It's actually explicitly written in the most recent Kelly memo that came out, that the prior sort of enforcement priorities is being replaced with this memorandum, and that there's no longer this sort of tiered prioritization that's going to only be focusing on serious, individuals with a serious criminal history, which is what purportedly the Obama administration was focused on under their priorities enforcement program, the PAP program is what.
Now let's talk about also this idea of expedited removal. Congress, I understand, had years ago passed a law that basically allowed immigrants, if they were caught within a certain amount of time after having been crossed and within a certain amount of geographic space, if you will, from the border, to simply remove them without access to due process. Is that, first of all, is that characterization accurate? And second, what do these memos say about that, if anything?
So, and in fact, actually, the law that was passed by Congress through IRA, it's under INA 235, the section that deals with expedited removal, as well as individuals appearing at the border, it does, in fact, contemplate removal of individuals who have not come through, you know, who've basically entered the United States without inspection, without authorization, and you know, who are found, like, basically the law does say that they can be removed if they can't prove having lived here continuously for a period of 2 years. So that was the law in the books. It's been the law for a while. However, the way it's been actually carried out has really differed through different administrations, and most definitely we haven't seen anything of the sort of nature that's being contemplated right now under the Kelly memo and the executive order. So, you know, for instance, for a long time, traditionally, the way expedited removal has been practiced has been really carried out for 100 miles from the border if someone has been found to have entered without inspection or admission, you know, since, like, it's for a 14-day period. So if you entered within a 14-day period and you're caught, then in those circumstances, immigration officers do have the authority to remove you, essentially, without giving you the opportunity to appear before a judge and make a case for why you should be allowed to stay.
Now, there's also this sort of informal setup, or maybe it's formal, since you're a lawyer, would know, called catch and release, where because, you know, of the numbers of people coming over the border and there not being enough detention space for them, under Obama, Border Patrol did have a practice of, if they picked up somebody who was undocumented, that they would be released once they had a court date. They would be released into the public, and then when their court date came up for being able to discuss there and have time in front of a judge for their immigration case, then they would be expected to show up. Is that something that was being widely practiced? And under Trump, do we see this? Will we see this end?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that this catch and release practice has become more of a, I mean, you know, in some cases, in some instances, it is true that they weren't categorically, you know, universally detaining every person that they interacted with at the border. But nevertheless, under Obama, we definitely saw an increase in detention as well as expedited removal of those who were being apprehended near the border. So the catch and release, you know, phenomenon, so to speak, wasn't exactly prevalent under the Obama years.
It's a favorite talking point for the right, though, right?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. To be perfectly honest with you, and someone who's been practicing and doing deportation defense work for nearly 10 years, I think that the catch and release practice happened more in the 90s than it has happened in, at least in the past 10 years that I've been practicing.
But
it's definitely been increased enforcement along the southern border, you know, for years.
It's something that the Trump administration likes to point as a previous administration being soft on immigrants, but you're saying that it wasn't a huge phenomenon to begin with.
Right. No. No, I mean, in fact, I think it's, you know, just even from the data that's been collected over the past several years, what we are seeing is that there's definitely been a notable, dramatic decrease in the number of individuals who are able to get through the border without inspection and without authorization. And that is in a large part, I mean, there's many factors, you know, for why that is. But definitely it's because there has been a lot of funding, a lot of money that's already been expended on increasing, you know, militarization of the border, increasing enforcement at the border. So it's definitely a myth to think that our borders are not secure.
So the other aspect, of course, that's a really, really big deal is that there are hundreds of thousands of young immigrants who registered under the DACA program that President Obama put in place, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Now, Trump has called this issue, quote, a very difficult subject for me. And the memoranda that Secretary Kelly signed leaves DACA in place. However, there was at least one instance near Seattle, Washington, over the past couple of weeks where a DACA registrant, I understand, was arrested. Do you know definitively whether DACA people are off limits or should they be scared?
You know, I think right now I would not say definitively right at prior to, you know, a couple weeks ago, there was a lot of suggestions, murmurs, and I believe that there was also like a leaked executive order that was canceling DACA, and that definitely there was a lot of heightened concern for the DACA community at this time. Though, what, like you just said, there seems to have been a lot of sort of pushback on the administration to not undo DACA, and that it does not seem like they're giving the sort of authorization to do that. That being said, I think that one thing that this is true for both DACA recipients, as much as it's true for someone who's a legal permanent resident, as well as, you know, an individual who does not have status or does not have authorization, that, you know, any of those groups and populations have any sort of interaction with law enforcement, both the Interior executive order as well as the Kelly memorandum, you know, sort of contemplate that those individuals are priority enforcement for both detention and deportation. So it's not to say that someone who has DACA is going to be protected in the event that they end up having a run-in with the law. And, you know, one of the sort of things that's most unsettling about the Interior Executive Order, as well as the DHS, the Kelly Memorandum, is that they're making a priority for, you know, individuals who haven't even been formally charged or convicted of a crime, that those individuals should become a deportation priority, including individuals who might not have actually even interacted with law enforcement, but, you know, that there could be some sort of case made that they have, in fact, they could be found in violation of the law because, let's say, you know, they've acted in such a way that their actions could fulfill those elements.
So, I mean, what's particularly frightening about DACA recipients is that they went from being one of the most protected classes of undocumented immigrants to being one of the most vulnerable because the government knows who they are. They, when they registered, gave their information to the government. And of all the undocumented immigrants in the U.S. now, the government has the most information, aside from those who might be in deportation proceedings, the government has the most information on those who are DACA recipients. So it's very frightening, certainly. And it seems as though that is the whole point of this, is to create this atmosphere of fear. You mentioned earlier that there was a leaked document that hinted that DACA recipients might be under threat. Another thing that was recently leaked was this very frightening story about Trump using the National Guard to round up and deport immigrants. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, that you need like a huge amount of manpower to be able to achieve what Trump wants to achieve. But when those stories became public, his administration flatly denied them, saying 100% they were not true. What do you make of this?
I mean, I definitely think the one takeaway is to terrorize the community, right? And I think it's an extremely effective strategy because here's the thing. For individuals who might be in deportation proceedings who do not have lawyers, if they know that, you know, like the military is going to be deployed to come and get them, or or that, you know, suddenly ICE is going to start showing up in immigration courthouses, they have every incentive. I mean, because, I mean, it's terrifying to for them to not appear in immigration court, for them to stay at home, for them to not send their children to school. And in doing so, you know, not only do they become even more vulnerable to being detained and to being deported because they could end up having an in absentia order, but it definitely, I mean, it's going to create all sorts of problems and obstacles for the community.
I even wonder if this idea of using the National Guard was a sort of trial balloon to see, you know, to have it be leaked to the press. And the major media reported that this was coming from inside the White House, not the fringe media, not the websites right. that have been known to conflate facts, if you will, with fiction. But I'm wondering if it was a sort of trial balloon for the administration to see what sort of reaction it would be met with, and when they realized that it was met with a very strong pushback, they completely backpedaled from it.
Right. And I, you know, actually, Sonali, that's a really good point that you mentioned, right? That the what the sort of the role that public the public's reaction is having to all this. And I will say that, you know, just looking at the airport ban and what happened there and the mass protests that took place all around the country. I mean, I think that that's actually been, it's been the one of the most effective ways of pushing back. And one thing that we really need to be careful about with this administration is that, you know, they might sort of leak some of the most extreme ideas, and you know, they might gauge what the public's reaction to that is, and then suddenly sort of suggest that they were never contemplating anything like that. And then, you know, when they turn around and just start doing like silently mass deportations, because it doesn't seem as extreme as putting the National Guard out there, suddenly there's not the same sort of public pressure being put on them. And they're, you know, being allowed, in other words, to sort of still carry on these plans of terror and mass deportation.
And of course, what it also does is it lowers our standards. Suddenly, we're breathing a sigh of relief that the National Guard isn't going to be deployed to round people up, and that it would take 2 years to ramp up Border Patrol and Homeland Security to do the same thing doesn't seem as scary now. I mean, you know, right. It's not clear how intentional all of these things are from the administration. Let's also talk about 287G, the role of law enforcement in immigration enforcement. This has been a very controversial and state-by-state sort of patchwork aspect of immigration policy. And some states and cities, but in particular sanctuary cities, have decided to very clearly say that their local law enforcement will not be involved in coordinating with ICE. What do these memos from Homeland Security this week on Trump's immigration policy say specifically about 287G and the role of local police?
Right. So they, you know, they, again, along with the same sort of, they use the same language from the interior memorandum that we saw a few weeks ago, that they expect to expand 287G, that they see this as, you know, a really sort of effective tool in being able to carry out immigration enforcement. And, you know, and we've seen a lot of like the sort of rhetoric that those cities and states that do not cooperate will fall victim to not receiving, you know, needed federal funds.
There was an interesting article in The Hill by somebody who used to work in Homeland Security under Obama, Amanda Baran, who had a piece entitled Donald Trump's War on Immigrant Women. And it's a really interesting piece. Amanda Baran was basically a former principal director of immigration policy at the Department of Homeland Security, where she co-founded the department's Council on Combating Violence Against Women. And she basically points to the dangers that immigrant women in particular face because of this idea that they might be much more afraid to call the police in situations of potential domestic violence if they're worried about being deported, which in turn can amplify violence that they face already. What do you make of this, and how important is it for us to acknowledge this?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, in fact, that's exactly why under the Obama administration, they did away with 287, the secured communities, because what they found through their studies was that, in fact, it had the opposite effect, right? Instead of like purportedly making communities safer, it made them even more vulnerable to harm. And the victims oftentimes were, you know, immigrant victims of crimes who were very scared to report that to the police because, you know, what they were terrified of happening is that the police would show up with ICE or that, you know, basically them sort of making themselves known to the police would eventually out them to ICE and that sooner or later ICE would come and detain them. And, you know, only simply because they were trying to make their community safer, to make themselves safer, to try to get, you know, assistance that that's legally theirs, you know, and to get the protection of the police. So that's actually very, very true. And definitely what studies have shown is that, you know, policies like secured communities, the effect of that, the brunt of it is borne on many, you know, women and children who are particularly, who might be even more vulnerable and more scared of actually reporting instances of domestic violence or crimes to the police.
And we should remember, of course, that President Obama wasn't necessarily a friend to all immigrant women. Under his administration, we saw the reopening of the so-called family detention centers, where particularly Central American undocumented women and their children, in many cases their babies, were being imprisoned, are still being imprisoned in, say, the Berks Detention Center in Pennsylvania. There's one in Arizona, I believe one in Texas. And, you know, whole families, mothers and children being imprisoned under Obama. So we certainly can't let President Obama off the hook. It's not that Trump is going to suddenly begin deporting immigrants who had been safe under Obama. It's been a continuum, right?
Exactly. Right. I mean, you know, I think that
that's why you've been doing work for the last 10 years protecting immigrants as a lawyer.
Right. Yes. I mean, like, I think that's exactly right, that there's already a very sort of sophisticated, like, you know, deportation detention system that's already been in place. That's something that's been building and expanding upon for, you know, it's not just during the Obama years, but definitely we saw an expansion of that. And that, you know, in many ways, it's made Trump's job much easier because the infrastructure is already in place. Now they just need to sort of continue the expansion of what was already there.
Yes, absolutely important for us to acknowledge that. The BBC, by the way, just as I mentioned earlier when we opened the story, mentioned the tragic case of a Mexican man who was who basically deported, and very soon after his deportation, within an hour, he threw himself off of a bridge and killed himself. He was under a lot of distress, expressed a lot of distress, did not want to go back to Mexico. And these are real people's lives. And speaking of people being deported to Mexico, I understand that another thing that this memorandum says is that anybody who's crossing the border could be sent back to Mexico, whether they are Mexican or not. So, for example, if an undocumented Chinese person crosses the border with Mexico, which does happen, that the U.S. will simply dump that Chinese person back onto Mexican soil, even if they are technically not documented within Mexico. That's kind of a strange new thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, I think that I understand there's a couple of things that are really strange about, you know, what the memo is suggesting. So one is, like you pointed out, that even individuals who are not actually nationals of Mexico or Canada, because it says contiguous territories, but even though the focus is definitely on the southern border, that they could be, you know, they could just be sent back. And then the second other sort of unsettling, really disturbing sort of policy that they want to put into place is to actually say that, you know, those individuals who are Mexican nationals who are in actual removal proceedings, they could still be sent back to Mexico and do their removal, participate in the removal proceedings through like televideo from Mexico. And this, you know, as you can imagine, is going to require a lot of cooperation from the Mexican government. They would actually have to build, you know, probably detention facilities in Mexico, as well as other sort of facilities, and, you know, extend the sort of immigration court, the U.S. immigration court access into Mexico, which, you know, I can't imagine that the Mexican government is going to agree to.
Especially given the tensions between the U.S. and Mexico under Trump over a recent meeting that the president had with the Mexican president, and also, of course, specifically this issue of building a border wall that Trump is going to get Mexico to pay for. Well, let's end, Meath, with some practical advice that's kind of generic that you might be able to offer to anybody who's watching or listening to this program who might be undocumented and who is very afraid at what has transpired, whether they are a DACA person or not. What are their rights in a scenario where, you know, maybe they live in a sanctuary city, maybe they don't? What are their rights if they get picked up by ICE, if ICE comes knocking on the door of their workplace or their home?
Right. So, you know, I think one of the most important rights that we always tell our clients or when we speak to the community is that if ICE comes to their door, right? First and foremost, before ICE can enter, they need to have a warrant. And
so just like regular police, like local law enforcement needs to have a warrant to enter your house.
Exactly.
ICE needs a warrant too.
Right. And so, you know, at least in Los Angeles and the areas where there's not this, you know, again, Los Angeles hasn't, Mayor Garcetti has definitely not explicitly stated that we are a sanctuary city. So I can't say that ICE won't show up with local law enforcement in our city. It's quite possible. But that being said, you know, what we've been hearing and what ICE normally does is what they can do is show up at someone's home and say, "We're the police," right? They're going to just say that they're not going to identify themselves as belonging to any department or agency specifically. They'll just call themselves the generic police. And, you know, I think that everyone needs to resist their initial urge, which it would be to just open the door because you think it's the police and you have to do that. And, you know, it's your right to not open that door, to ask them to identify themselves, and then ask them if they have a warrant. If they do have a warrant, ask them to pass it through to you. You know, it'd be best if you could have them pass it through a window. You can have them pass it through like a mail, you know, a sort of drop-in mail thing.
Slide it under the door, maybe.
Exactly, under the door, if that's possible, through the side of the door. And if that warrant, you need to look at that warrant, and it needs to be signed by a judge. And in this case, generally speaking, ICE is not going to have a warrant signed by a judge.
Wow.
So if they do not, you do not let them in. Do not need to. I mean, that is definitely your right. If they do end up getting in somehow, let's say someone just, you inadvertently do open the door, then they can walk in. And if at that point they ask you any questions, you should, you know, we give out through our community, they can definitely reach our office and we would be more than happy to give them a Know Your Rights card that they can present to an ICE officer, where they do not need to speak to the ICE officer. They do not need to answer any questions. They could invoke their right to speak with an attorney. And you know, from that moment forward, I would very much recommend that family members have, you know, like the hotline, a hotline number that they have access to, or if they have an attorney that they know of, to have that attorney's number on hand to immediately contact that attorney to let them know what is going on. Similarly, if there's a workplace raid, you know, obviously it's up to the employer if they're going to let ICE in. And in doing so, you know, any of the individuals who are targeted in that raid should follow the same course, which is to not answer any questions, and you know, to say that they would like to speak with an attorney. You know, if individuals are green card holders, I would definitely say that they should make that be known, and show proof of their green card, of their residency to ICE, because most certainly individuals who are green card holders have more due process rights.
Right. And we didn't actually get around to talking about green card holders. That might be the subject of another conversation. Give out a website for the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, Meath.
Yes, it's www.immdef.org.
Immdef.org, immdef.org. Meath, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Meath Soni is the directing attorney with Immigrant Defenders Law Center. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.